And I was sitting there, and I was huddling, I remember, one morning with my cup of tea, and I was thinking about how happy I was, that I had never been as happy in my life as I was at that moment. And then what rushed through my mind was, many years before, I don't remember which war it was, it was probably the Korean War, maybe, that I had been in a barber shop waiting for the barber, and I was looking through a Life magazine, and I remembered at the time seeing one of the American airmen who had been shot down, and he had been put in a concentration camp in somewhere or other, Korea or somewhere, and these pictures had been stolen out, snuck out from the camp, and they were showing the horrible life this guy was leading. And they showed him, and he was sitting in this small room, and he was sitting on a mat, and they said he gets one plate a day of some rice and some heavy bread, and he washes out of a pail, and he's just there, and he's looking forlorn, and he's sitting there. And I thought, far out. And that image crashed through, and I thought, isn't that bizarre? It's exactly the same situation. And for me, when I read through this volume on voluntary simplicity, in which I'm writing the preface, I realized that the more you become aware, the less the stuff of life pulls on you, and there are tremendous changes in your economic and social styles of life. It just gets simpler and simpler and simpler as you become more aware. And that a lot of things that we're biting the bullet for somebody in middle-class materialistic world is absolutely obvious and right on for somebody who is more conscious. So what happens is that that's why my argument always is that the way in which a society improves is by the work on oneself that people do and the increase in consciousness. And it doesn't mean that you can walk away from all these moral dilemmas and make these decisions again and again. And all you can do is go into your heart, feel as well as you can. You can't not act, because even non-action is action. Non-voting is a vote for a certain breakdown of a system, right? So you've got to play. And then you play as consciously as you can within the ignorance you got. And you live with the confusion and the chaos of it. And there's no certainty in the game. Yes?
A long time ago, I heard you talk about Kali and about feeding your something, your fault or something to her and letting her eat it. And I've never been able to really understand that. Somehow, something about that eludes me.
Well, just as you saw that when Jai said that Kali's holding the heads, and the heads are ego, meaning it's attachments or clinging, and that's what it is that you're letting go of, and that Kali cuts away and goes after the impurities that keep you from Shiva or from God or from merging, right? And so that form is always ready to receive that impurity. It's like, it's a way of invoking aid, if you will, to help release this. And it's like saying, oh God, take this from me. And you're only calling that aspect of God which is into the taking business, okay? And so you're merely saying, oh Kali, here, I offer this to you, you take this. And you use purification, have a Kali puja. You invoke Kali like some fire ceremonies. We invoke Kali, and then Kali dances, and then you throw into the fire the stuff you would get rid of. Okay? Yeah.
I've been watching myself. I have a twofold question. I've been trying to figure out in my own psychologically twisted mind how they're actually connected. The first is, I'm feeling peaceful and harmonious and getting a lot of light from this experience. And there's this other part of me that today especially has been feeling really rebellious. The part of me that wants to drive into town and eat a hamburger. And I really want to put the AM radio on and listen to the news of the world. Even though at home I have a hard time, I have to force myself to listen to AM and say, okay, now once a day you have to listen to the news. I'm feeling the sense of the beauty of this experience, and at the same time, I have a tongue in cheek and say, well, it's okay for us to be really high, 160 of us in this little teeny unit in the desert, but then what's going to happen when? The other part of the question is, what would you say to someone who...
I'm just following that mind you were describing. Go ahead. Yes.
That wasn't the psychologically twisted part. This is the second part. It's making the connection. What would you say to someone who, about death? What would you say to someone about death who, in their belief system, either has no place for or who has lots of doubt regarding reincarnation and karma?
Well, let me take the second. What would you say to somebody who has lots of doubt? I wouldn't say anything. Let me answer the second one. I feel very, very strongly. I don't feel strongly about anything, but I appear to feel strongly. You think you have a twisted mind. I feel very fortunate in that I don't feel that my game is that of proselytizing. I think I'm very lucky that it seems to me that I just have to work on myself and be. And those that want something ask, and I have available whatever I have available, and if it's of use to them, fine, and if it isn't, fine. And I live among my father, who was not the least bit interested in reincarnation and karma and doesn't want to talk about death and is 81 and has plenty of fear. And I have to love him and give him the space to hold on to his fear. It's none of my business to force him to see the world the way I see it. Because the way I see it may be totally psychotic for all I know. It's just the way I see it. And what I think is going to get rid of my his suffering may just exacerbate his suffering. I can't run the world. I'm not God. I don't know what's good for other people. All I know is that I will be what I am, and I will be available to people as they wish it. But I live within, I honor the differences in incarnation. Some people are deep in one value system, some in another. My job isn't to manipulate somebody else to get them over into my value system. My job is to make it available and just make it known that it exists, and then let whoever wants to dance, dance. Okay? So I'm very careful about that. I really don't proselytize. I never speak where I'm not invited to speak. I mean, I don't go out to do that kind of thing. That just isn't my trip. Now, it may be others' trips, and it may be done from very, very high motives. It just doesn't happen to be the way I work. Okay, so you're asking me, what would you do? I'm telling you what I would do, okay? And I can love somebody incredibly, like I love my father, and still not lay a trip on him. I mean, in some funny sense, I'm in the dying business. And here's my father, whose major concern is, at 81 years old, is, you know, how to keep it together. And he and I talk about baseball, and we talk about life and love and everything, but we never get near death because he doesn't really want to. And every time I'm giving us, I could be out on his front lawn giving a talk to 300 people about death, and he'll walk in and watch the ball game. And that's his right to watch the ball game. It's his house, for God's sakes. What am I going to say? Hey, Pa, get out here and listen to death. But it was very far out that recently he was having a very minor operation for an obstruction in his bladder. But at 80 years old, any operation is a little delicate. And we were in the hospital room the night before the operation and just hanging out, my stepmother and he and I. And we have a lot of fun together, and we just kind of kidding each other. And we got up to leave, and my stepmother left, and I was just leaving, and she said, I'll meet you downstairs, and I was saying goodbye to him, and the next morning he was going to be operated on. And as I was leaving, this is beautiful, I'm just putting on my coat to leave, he says, by the way, he says, I know this operation's going to be nothing,
You know, it's going to be a piece of cake. He says, but just in case I should die, what's going to happen? This is like, in 25 words or less, as I'm leaving the room, would you just tell me what's going to happen? So I'll, you know. And so I had 25 words or less. So I said to him, well, all I can tell you is, as good as it is here, it's going to be better. And I'll meet you on the other side. He says, great, that's all I wanted to know. See you later. And in a way, that's our dialogue. And I'm not laying any more trips on him because he's not asking. Okay, Judith? Yes.
When you plant a seed, and some seeds come to fruition, and some don't, is it possible to say that the karmic responsibility is not that as much of the child as of the mother, and or the expectant mother, and that the suffering that is involved in attempting, knowing that we are asleep, in attempting to make a conscious decision, and a conscious communion, and a choice that says, if you're not pushing and you're not pulling, but you want to make right effort in some way, that there is a choice to be made, doesn't that have to do with karmic responsibility as well?
Yeah. I remember Trungpa Rinpoche saying to me one night, we were all a little drunk as usual, so I can't tell whether it was what level it came from, but we were talking about abortions. And he said to actually a gal who was in the room that was pregnant and asking about it, he says, you've got to realize that when an abortion occurs, that the karma involves all three of the beings involved, and that the being that gets aborted at some level chose to enter into a non-supportive environment that would reject it. And that is an incarnation for it. Okay? So in that sense, he was saying that sometimes the beings need to abort forces the parents' minds to create those thoughts which lead to the abortion. So it's not clear from the act where the karma lies. I'm not saying where the karma lies. I'm just saying that there is karma involved in any time you manipulate the universe out of any model you have about how you think it ought to be. Okay? And as far as when the consciousness enters a fetus, there really are a lot of disparities in understanding of that. And in some systems, the more conscious the being, the later it enters the fetus. And sometimes it enters just before birth, while in a less conscious being, it may enter way back and work out a lot of karma through that. And in fact, in very conscious beings, sometimes they actually put what's called a shade or a shadow ego into a being that'll live with it for like 20, 30 years. And then when they need that body, they take it over. And sometimes you see a being who was one personality and suddenly they changed around and they got this incredible illuminated spiritual being in there, like somebody entirely different. And you almost could understand it that way. I mean, I don't have any direct experience of it, but I think the game is just much more exquisite than our minds yet deal with it, okay?